Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT. Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, Episode 33, Dr. Milner's Explorations into the Human Mind. Futures in Biotech is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of spoken word entertainment. Get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. Log on to Audible.com/biotech today for details. Welcome to Futures in Biotech. I'm Mark Peltier. Today's guest, we're very fortunate to have Dr. Brenda Milner from the Montreal Neurological Institute and McGill University. She is an outstanding scientist. She has a career that has spanned 60 years, and she's won numerous awards, including 19 honorary degrees. She's a fellow. She's won the fellowships of the Royal Society of Canada and of London, for an associate title of the National Academy of Sciences in the USA, officers of the Order of Canada and Quebec, first recipient of the Wilder Penfield Prize for Biomedical Research, member of the Canadian Medical Hall of Fame, Golden Jubilee Medal of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, National Academy of Sciences Award in Neurosciences in 2004, and even more recently, a companion to the Order of Canada, a position that is only held by four people. I don't know. Was that okay?
That's great. Edit that. Yeah. No, I like it.
Well, that voice you hear is Dr. Dave Broadbeck, Canadian psychologist and chair of the Department of Psychology at Algoma University in Sault Ste. Marie. I invited him to help me with the introduction because I really wanted to give Dr. Milner the introduction that she deserves and to really tap into how her career has changed or moved forward what we know about the human mind.
Well, Mark, I mean, it's funny. Coincidentally, yesterday I was marking final exams in a course called Brain and Behavior that I teach. And that course would not be possible without the work of Brenda Milner. I actually got a chance to meet her. One of those honorary degrees was given to her by Memorial University of Newfoundland when I was there. And I got a chance to hang out with her a bit. And I'll tell you something. I have not met anybody that's this dynamic of any age. And what she's done is she's taken psychology, and she was a psychologist by training, and neuroscience then, neurology, and sort of blended them together into what we today call cognitive neuroscience. There would not be, like I said, my course, there wouldn't be a field called cognitive neuroscience without Brenda Milner, and without especially, she'll probably talk today about her work with AGM. And that changed everything. That changed psychology. That turned us into a science that maybe some of my older colleagues may not like this, but one that was a little bit too concerned with looking at rats pressing at bars and pigeons pecking at keys. And believe me, I've done some of that myself. But it took us from that into something looking at internal mental events and looking at them from a scientific perspective and looking at the corresponding neuroanatomy and physiology. And I mean, when I got to meet her in 2002, it was like I had met a combination of Bono and and like Bono, and then if Bono was a scientist, except you know, I mean, it was incredible, and it was like that. I was starstruck, except that she was just so nice and warm and wonderful, and we talked a little bit about science, a lot about hockey.
and so she was born in 1918, and has really influenced generations of psychologists.
Yeah, I mean, I look back, she's one of the awards she won that you didn't have on your list was the Hebb Award. Donald Hebb was her PhD supervisor and probably one of the greatest experimental psychologists ever, along with her, from the Canadian Society of Brain Behavior and Cognitive Science in 2001. And other past recipients of the award are people like Gus Craik, Endel Tulving. There wouldn't be Gus Craik and Endel Tulving without Brenda Milner. There wouldn't be, you know, Kendall's work. And you had Kendall on the show, and he's credited her. I mean, she's not only influenced psychology and neurology because she also worked with Penfield, but she's influenced this and helped invent a brand new field of cognitive neuroscience, which is something that not a lot of people, you don't get to meet a lot of people that have invented a whole discipline.
Well, you were mentioning as well that in our conversations that how we were going to talk about her past work. And this is, of course, a show called Futures in Biotech.
Futures, yeah.
The future. But how has her work influenced the various fields and that are moving forward in the area of psychology?
Well, I mean, there's a few ways, and some of them are very specific and obvious. There's things like if we're going to look for cures for things like, let's say, autism, let's say schizophrenia, let's say people with amnesia, perhaps. Let's think of, attention deficit disorder, whatever. If we're going to find cures for these kind of things, we have to know how the brain works, and somebody has to understand the physiology and the anatomy, but somebody has to design the clever behavioral experiments that fit in with the anatomy and physiology, with the MRIs, et cetera. And we wouldn't know how to do that that's what cognitive neuroscience does. So that's on one very tangible level. On another more, I guess, tangential level in some respects, one of the big things that she did with the case of HM is she gave, I guess you'd call it, anatomical and physiological proof that there are multiple memory systems in the brain and that we could actually study these things scientifically. And of course, nowadays we look at artificial intelligence. They use neural networks, things like this. So in that respect too, looking at stuff that you might not always think of every day as what psychology and, say, cognitive neuroscience has done. That's doing things like running the traffic signals in cities is being done with artificial intelligence neural networks. And I mean, without her work, her pioneering work, really none of this stuff could happen. So we'd all be stuck in traffic.
Well, she won the Gardner Prize in 2005, right? So that gives her about a 1 in 4 chance for the Nobel laureate, to become the Nobel laureate. I don't want to jinx her.
Neither would I.
You know. Okay, well, thank you very much for helping me out with the introduction.
Not a problem, Mark.
It was very important to get this right. And so I will move on to the interview.
Thanks.
When did you move to Canada? So you're at the Montreal Neurological Institute. But how did you make it to where you are now in terms of when you started?
I came to Montreal in 1944 when I thought that I was coming for a year, I believed. I started my life in mathematics, actually, and I was working on a radar research establishment. I turned over to psychology at Cambridge, and I was working on a radar research establishment in Malvern in England during World War II. And that's where I met Peter Milner, I married, who was an electrical engineer, and he was designing the equipment that that I was actually testing out. We were testing out the proper methods of display and control for the radar operators. As you know, radar played a big role in the Battle of Britain and in World War II. And then when we knew that the war was coming to an end in England, war in Europe, not the war all over, I was making plans to return to Cambridge, my university. But suddenly, Peter Milner, with whom I had become very close friends, was invited in quotes, I mean, you don't refuse these invitations, to go with a group of scientists led by Sir John Cockcroft from Cambridge to Canada to set up the beginnings of Canadian atomic energy research. It was a very sudden thing that had to happen within a week or two. So on the spur of the moment, we got married and we came over here supposedly for a year. And that actually began this atomic energy research in one wing of the Université de Montréal, the French university here, before it moved to Chalk River, which you've probably heard of. During that period, I got a job in French University at the Université de Montréal because I'd always liked French and I'd never had a chance really to use it. But for the first time I was teaching in French about animal behavior and about psychology. It was a great challenge, but it was a wonderful experience. And it was in the middle of that that McGill University psychology department, which had been really rather in the doldrums during the war because the people had gone off to do other things, it began to pull itself together, and they recruited Donald Hebb, who became a very very famous for his work on his book, The Organization of Behavior. People talk about the Hebb synapse and so on. But Hebb came to McGill, and he had previously, he was a Canadian, and he had previously spent a year or so here at the Neurological Institute with Wilder Penfield at the beginning. The Neurological Institute here was founded in 1934, and it was really devoted at that time. The goal of it was the pioneering the neurosurgical treatment of epilepsy, which was really very novel. And so Dr. Hebb in those days had the opportunity to study one or two of Dr. Penfield's patients and really believed that it was important to, that you could get important information from about the normal healthy brain by studying essentially the brain of the person that had some brain lesion or brain damage. I had been brought up in that belief in England too, so I certainly agreed with that and still do. So when Hebb came back to head up the psychology department at McGill, he got a promise from Dr. Penfield that he could send one graduate student to study the patients at the Neuro. In the meantime, I, of course, was at teaching, a professor at the University of Montreal, but I attended the first Hebb seminar at McGill with a lot of number of quite well-known people like Morton Mishkin and so on were in that first group, and we went through all Hebb's chapter by chapter, this book that was to become so famous. It was just in manuscript, and we read it chapter by chapter and all the background reading, and I became very excited by this and decided that I realized that I needed a PhD. In England, people did not in those days or before the war, even if the university professors did not go on to the PhD, it wasn't considered sort of necessary. The first earlier degrees were the really competitive and important ones, but I realized that in North America it was important. And I was really, I think we were all inspired by Hebb, his ideas. And so I decided I wanted to do a PhD at McGill, and I wanted to do it with Hebb. I had some work to persuade him, because you always had to persuade him. He always said no to people at first, just to prove how serious they would test, how serious they were. And once I had agreed that he had accepted me, I started doing some research on perception in the congenitally blind. I had some experiments going, a tactile concept formation in the congenitally blind. I just got this going. When Hebb asked me if I would like to go and to study Penfield's patients, that was June 1950. And as soon as I got up here, I say here because I'm talking to you, of course, from the Neuro, I realized that I just found this so fascinating and that this is what I wanted to do. And after I got my PhD, I had thought I would go back to I had a tenured, really, teaching position. And in the 50s, you know, it was hard to come by good jobs, and it was, I didn't have any money, and have assumed that I would just continue with my work once I'd got the PhD. And it was, and I certainly enjoyed the University of Montreal, and I enjoyed working in French, but the temptation to stay at the Neuro was too great, and I stayed. He said very grudgingly, he told me I was a fool. He said, no psychologist. No, he really said that. He said, no psychologist can survive for long at the Montreal Neurological Institute.
Wow.
So you're a fool, really. Essentially, he was a very outspoken, straightforward guy, and he told me it was very foolish.
Was he wrong?
And I said, I'd like to try. So he said, well, I'll support you out of my research funds. He had some money from Ottawa for 1 year, and you can have a little office in the psychology department, and not at the Neuro, but down in psychology on the lower campus at McGill. And but that's it, you know, and you really are very foolish. So I gave up my job at the U of M, and before the end of the year, and this was really quite amazing, Dr. Penfield suddenly said to me, we need you. You have to come up to the Neuro. We'll find you some little office space and so on. We need you. And that the great Dr. Penfield would never be saying, we need you. I had never thought. And of course, the reason he said this was because by that time, we had run into the problem of patients with memory disturbance, two patients with memory disturbance after an elective surgery for epilepsy. And up to that time, I think Dr. Penfield thought that he could, he liked having people come from different disciplines studying his patients. He encouraged visitors from all over. But he, I think he felt himself that psychology was really common sense and that he had lots of common sense, which was true, and that he could probably, you know, get along fine. It was nice to have a psychologist as a sort of little luxury, but not essential to his life. But then when he ran into these memory impairments, he really was very, very concerned and wanted to understand as much about them as possible. And that was when, unfortunately for the patient, but luckily for me, my luck turned and I was invited to come here. And I'm still here after, 58 years I've been here now. So that's quite a long time.
58 years.
That's my long answer to your short question.
Well, that's an excellent answer. So from what I understand, with your background in psychology, going to a clinical environment or a research clinical environment that really works on the anatomy and the function of the human brain was a really great was an insightful move and obviously risky, especially if you're leaving a good teaching position at Université de Montréal, which is.
Yes, yes, it was risky, I think. I mean, Hebb certainly thought it was. And it's very funny, you know, that a lot of other people thought so, because the correct thing to do for a psychologist then was to work either with rats or with healthy undergraduates, right? I mean, I wasn't a clinician. I wasn't a clinical psychologist. I was an experimental psychologist, so I should be working either with rats or with undergraduates where you could, you know, and do well-designed experiments. And that was the way to go. And people did think I was very foolish. The amusing thing is that years and years later, people said to me, oh, Brenda, you were so lucky having that opportunity, you know, because now, of course, everybody thinks this is an interesting and important thing to have done. But at the time, it was not viewed that way. And as I say, Hebb himself, who was very, very interested, still thought it was incredibly risky, as, you know, if you have to earn your living. But it was so fascinating.
Well, that's how paradigms change. If you don't take a risk, then there's no chance of paradigm change in science.
Yes, I think that's true. But you realize that I can't claim that I was doing this because I had some, if you get this straight from the beginning, I was not doing this because I had some wonderful theoretical model that I wanted to test out while working with these patients. I'm very empirical, I'm very sort of driven by the phenomena I encounter. I encounter something strange, a memory impairment or what have you, and then I want to investigate, to try to understand it better. But it's not that I go in with a great theory that I want to study. Yeah. It's different. I'm empirically driven, so to speak.
And you don't seem to be, and this is in 1950 that 50.
Yes, 50.
So you were taking on the human brain with the tools of a psychologist and with the data of a neurosurgeon.
That's right.
So how did you learn the anatomy? Or in your training in psychology, did they give you the anatomical functional details, or was it through behavior?
Well, it was a little bit of both. The Cambridge School, I was lucky in going to Cambridge. I mean, I went to Cambridge because it was a place to go in mathematics, and I was doing mathematics. And so I was very lucky, because then I changed over to psychology, that I was in a department that was very biologically oriented, because there was the influence before Professor Bartlett, who actually was an expert on memory, although I was not particularly interested in memory at that point. But the head of the department is a very famous writer on memory also, not memory in the brain so much, but experimental psychology of memory, Frederick Bartlett. But the people before him, his seniors, were Henry Head and Rivers. These were neurologists with an interest in behavior. And there was a whole tradition that this was the difference in England between the two big schools in psychology then were Cambridge and London. And London and Scotland. And these were two different traditions. The London tradition was very much towards statistics, measurements of intelligence, towards very elaborate development of statistical methods. Method, extremely good statistics. The Cambridge Method was very experimental. The degree is a degree in experimental psychology, and always thinking of, Bartlett always talked about the organism, the person. He was always influenced by this idea that that the brain is responsible for what you do. But we knew very little about, I knew the broad anatomy of the brain, but I had not done, and don't forget, I came through mathematics and physics. I hadn't done physiology or biology or anything like that as a lab. I've not worked in wet labs, you know. I came by a different route in my science. But we did know the sort of basic anatomy from our books. Don't forget also working with these patients, and this is what I always tell the medical students or anybody that I lecture to who's young today, that you have to have really a leap of imagination backwards, because in those days we didn't even have CT scan. We didn't, if you're discussing trying to assess a patient, you know, because a patient coming in with seizures and can the surgeon help the seizures with an operation? You are trying to make your interpretation of what is going on the basis of the clinical pattern of the epilepsy, of the EEG, which was extremely primitive. We had Herbert Jasper, who's a colleague of Dr. Penfield, a brilliant electroencephalographer, a very good neurophysiologist, but he was at the very beginnings of the field of EEG. Also, all we knew about what was inside the skull of this patient, we knew the shape of the ventricles, and we knew the plain films of the skull, but we knew nothing. I mean, it's not that we didn't have beautiful structural MR. We didn't have, as I say, a CT scan. We didn't really know much until actually and Dr. Penfield turned a big bone flap, which was unusual in those days, and started at the electrical stimulation of the awake patient, of the brain of the awake patient to map out areas and to try to elicit the beginnings of a seizure. So we knew extremely little. When you asked me what I knew of the anatomy, I learned sort of hands-on. I learned to know a lot more about the about the human brain, obviously, because we were working with patients with brain lesions. We were in the operating room. We were getting and in the gallery, actually, where the EEG, the electrocorticography, was going on, and seeing the electrical activity. We were studying all these things, and at the time, I was sort of learning these things on the job, I suppose.
Or, oh, wow.
Yes, that would be a fair thing to say.
Literally looking into someone's head. That's amazing.
it was one of the great, in those days in Montreal, I remember when we had a big visit, we had International Congress of Psychology, I remember, met in Montreal, and that was because it was during the McCarthy era, and so many of the foreign scientists couldn't get visas to go to the United States, so they could come to Canada, and so we had this big meeting in Montreal, and one of the things that the delegations were always coming up when Dr. Penfield was operating to come and look in the gallery and see this brain stimulation in the awake patient. It was very innovative in those days, I think. I think Dr. Penfield studied with Surgeon Fuster in Germany briefly in order to get an idea of how this could be done, and then came here and really pioneered this work in Montreal.
How did the patients react to the idea of this going on? Were they, obviously they were willing patients. This is very, very experimental. And what's going through the, what's going through the mind of the patient that he's going to have 30, 40 people watching him or more, while these are severe patients, severely epileptic and need of.
Not severe in the sense of having dreadful seizures. The temporal lobe epilepsy, most of these patients had temporal lobe epilepsy, and the temporal lobe epilepsy, the seizures actually they're usually a sort of change in your ongoing behavior, what Hewlings-Jackson in England called a dreamy state. People suddenly behave in a slightly odd way. They may just start fumbling if you're testing them, or humming a tune, or they may go and if they're, you know, put something inappropriate in the ice box or do during this period when they're behaving in a slightly strange way and they're not responding to you when you talk to them, then they're they have no memory afterwards of this period of the epileptic attack. And then afterwards, there may be a period of confusion as they, or not, as the case may be, as they return to just to their normal state. They may not even know that they've had an attack. But so these are not, you know, when you say severe, they're not, it's not, but it's very, it's something that is really very, intolerable is too strong a word. It's very hard to take for patients. First of all, they're taking medication, and most patients don't really like taking a lot of medication. They feel it slows them down in some way. There have been studies now, of course, this whole thing has become much more refined, and it is done all over this temporal lobe surgery particularly. And here you find that there's been really extensive studies showing that the quality of life in the patients whose seizures are controlled by the surgery is really significantly better. But there are all kinds of things that they can't do when they're having seizures. They can't drive. They can't. It's things like this. It's the nuisance value in their daily life, and their feeling that they are slowed down by, whether it's true or not, they certainly feel slowed down sometimes by the medications they're taking. So they're very motivated. They're highly motivated to be helped to control those seizures, you know. So, and they're very, they tend to be very grateful to the surgeon if it does help, you know. And I don't know if that answers your question.
Absolutely. So in your work on piecing together the function of memory or the processes of memory.
Oh, we haven't pieced it together yet. Fortunately, there's lots of questions.
Well, it goes down to the atomic level,
yes.
I suppose, with Dr. Kandel's work as well.
Yes.
But it has to be approached from every facet.
Right. Right, his work is wonderful, but yes, that's right. Looking at the molecular side of it, and I'm looking at the systems level, right?
In these first patients that were undergoing epilepsy surgery for epilepsy, how did you piece together your framework for questions? I know that you're very curious. Did you have to go through exhaustive night after night of thinking, how can I get an understanding or a sort of a global context? Because the brain, did you approach it reductionist with the approach of a reductionist?
No, I wasn't trying. Well, don't forget, I'm an experimental psychologist. So I go there, and when I went to the neuro, I was not interested particularly in memory. I was interested in perception. And I have always been, you know, inspired by a great deal by the experimental work with monkeys and with the rats. And a colleague of mine, Mort Mishkin, who had been a student at McGill, who's now still at NIH, carrying out important work on the temporal lobes of monkeys. And I was getting hypotheses from what we knew in the monkey for what one might look for in people. And so I was looking for visual deficits, because it had been shown in monkeys with bilateral damage that the damage to the inferior surface of the temporal lobe in the monkey, it was associated with difficulties in learning based on visual cues, in learning that a square meant you were going to get a piece of banana or something like that, and whereas if you choose a diamond, you're not going to get anything. This is a pattern discrimination learning. We were finding that, I wasn't. The people working with monkeys were finding that the back in those days, faraway days of the early 50s, that the inferior part of the temporal lobe, temporal cortex, was important for this kind of visually guided learning. And later, others showed that another part of the temporal lobe was important for auditory discrimination and so on. Now, my challenge was to see patients who were having unilateral, and don't forget that, of course, this elective surgery is unilateral, Montreal. It's taking out part of one temporal lobe, in the assumption that in the other hemisphere, the temporal lobe is working normally. So it's a unilateral procedure. And whereas in the monkeys, in order to see the function of the temporal lobes, you had to have a bilateral lesion, you know, and unilateral, you would not see anything. And so I knew that I would be looking for some very subtle changes if it was just in one hemisphere, and avoiding, of course, areas critical for language in the left hemisphere and so on. Whatever I was looking for was going to be very subtle. Fortunately, because for the patients, because whatever they have in a way of subtle deficit is what they, in exchange for that, they get the control of their seizures, and it's a good bargain. That means that I'm looking for small things. That didn't bother me, as long as they're quantitatively orderly and I have a group of patients having a left temporal removal in the dominant hemisphere for speech, and I have another group having a right, and I can compare and contrast statistically, then I'm happy with these small things. But I wasn't thinking about memory. I was thinking about these higher level visual functions. And I remember Dr. Penfrey was rather surprised at that, because he said the temporal lobe is quite a long way from the visual cortex. Why are you interested in vision? But of course, he didn't know the monkey work, and it was because of the monkey work I was interested in vision. And so I did, in fact, for my thesis, produce evidence of some minor complex visual deficits in patients with unilateral temporal lobe lesions. And I got interested in something that became quite a passion with me, stayed with me, was teasing out the special functions of the right hemisphere, the non-speaking hemisphere, the sort of underprivileged. I got rather annoyed with hearing neurologists talking about the dominant hemisphere when they should have been saying the dominant hemisphere for speech, you know, because speech isn't everything. So I became a champion, I think, for the right hemisphere, and interested in trying to find out things that were going on in the right hemisphere. But in the middle of all this, I'm talking, of course, to my patients. I go and get the patients and we chat. And the patients have their own complaints. And when their complaints, particularly the patients with left temporal epileptic foci and so on, start saying, oh, doctor, well, I wasn't doctor then, but oh, you know, I have this trouble with my memory. And if a patient starts complaining about memory, you can't say, well, I'm not interested in memory. Don't you understand I'm working on visual perception? You're interested, you work on what your patient is telling you about himself or herself. And when they say, I have trouble with my memory, you think, aha, I should look into this. And then the patient, so you ask the patient what they mean, because obviously these patients are not amnesic. They're going from day to day about their business. They're not forget. They know who I am and so on. What do you mean by trouble with your memory? And then the patients with left temporal lesions give their examples, and they're all from the field of language. And remember, these are young patients. The average age of my patients at that time was in the mid-20s. They're a bit older now that we see, I think. But in those days, they were young patients. And so you should have a good memory in your 20s, most people have pretty good memories in their 20s. And they were complaining that they didn't remember people's names. They would go to a lecture and they wouldn't remember what they heard. But also when they were reading and studying, they didn't remember either. In other words, it wasn't specific to one sensory modality, such as vision through reading or audition through listening. It was the material, the fact that it was verbal. And these same people, so I began to study this, and these same people that were complaining of memory, because people value language so much. So they say, I have a terrible memory. And in fact, they just have a terrible verbal memory, and not a terrible, a poor. And so I start measuring this and show that they do indeed have verbal memory deficits. And I look at, but they don't have any difficulty in remembering unfamiliar tasks where they have to remember faces or nonsense patterns or nonsense designs or music. They have no problem. It's specifically verbal, although they call it a memory deficit. It's a material specific one. And then when I look at the patients with right temporal lesions, I find that these right temporal patients, the ones who have a removal from the right non-dominant, there you go, the minor hemisphere, there you go, bad words, have no trouble with verbal memory. But they have trouble with memory for faces and for places and so on. And so I became interested in these subtle deficits, which were very orderly. And this was really what I was working on and what I was doing when I begged Heb to let me, when I gave up my job at the U of M. I was very intrigued by these small differential effects depending on the side. This was before all the split brain patients whom I was able to study of Roger Sperry's later, but this was before the corpus callosum patients were studied. It was very small but very orderly changes. And it was in the middle of all this that one of Dr. Penfield's patients developed a severe generalized memory impairment. And it was this case and another case, and I'd like to say something about them, but this was what simulated Penfield to say to me, we need you.
I would like to take a short minute to thank Audible.com for sponsoring Futures of Biotech. They have over 50,000 titles now, I think. Just an amazing library of Audible books, speeches, interviews, shows, kids' books, fiction, nonfiction. They have almost anything you can think of. My pick of the week is a science fiction book by Jerry Purnell, and that is indeed the Jerry Purnell that wrote the column in Byte magazine for 20 years and is often a host on This Week in Tech on the same network with Leo. His book is entitled Star Swarm. It's about a child living on a research outpost on a distant planet. The child has heard a voice in his head for as long as he can remember. One day, finally daring to ask the voice some really tough questions, he discovers that his computer scientist parents had implanted a chip with artificial intelligence which interfaced with his mind. He also learns that his parents died under suspicious circumstances, and his very existence is a well-kept secret. And when the secret is revealed, his life and the whole outpost at Star Swarm are in danger. So if you'd like to download Star Swarm, head over to audible.com/biotech and sign up for a 14-day free trial. If you like the service, you can stay with it. And if you don't, well, you get to keep the free book. Now, back to the interview.
Now I should go back to the temporal lobes. Up to now, sure. I've been talking to you, first of all, about the monkey data and then about people, emphasizing really the temporal neocortex, what you see on the surface of the brain. But of course, the temporal lobe has these structures deep to it, and medial temporal structures, particularly the hippocampus, this beautiful orderly structure, surrounding it, entorhinal, perirhinal cortex, medial structures on the medial surface of the temporal lobe. And when Dr. Penfield first began to work on temporal lobe epilepsy, before I came to the neuro in those early days in the early 1940s, he was very conservative. He was a very prudent surgeon, and he decided to remove. He was really always trying to remove as little as possible to control the epilepsy. He was searching for a focus for where the epilepsy originated, and hoping he could get away with a small removal, and help the epilepsy. But he found out in the course of those first few years that he very rarely, sometimes, but very rarely succeeded in controlling the patient's seizures unless he extended his removal to include structures on the medial aspect of the temporal lobe, the amygdaloid nucleus and the part of the hippocampus. And so by the time that I started working with Penfield in the early 50s, we would almost call this a routine. Every patient, the removal was always tailored to the individual patient's problem. It was done under local anesthesia. He tried to elicit the beginnings of a seizure and so on and so forth. But practically all of the removals were involving the medial structures as well as the lateral surface of the temporal lobe in one hemisphere. Now, and also during this period, some of the earlier patients, the ones who had been there in the early 40s and had the more restricted removals, were still having seizures. And so Penfield took them back to have to complete the temporal lobectomy. Penfield realized by now that his removal had not been extensive enough, that he should have invaded the hippocampus and so on. And so the patients came back and had a second surgery. And one such patient that I saw, the first such patient that I saw, we'll call PB, was an engineer from New Jersey, I think, a very bright man, ran his own engineering office, was married and had a grown-up daughter, I think, and was quite an active social life. And he had had this left dominant hemisphere temporal removal with Dr. Penfield some years earlier. He came back in 1951, still having seizures. I tested him extensively, as I did all these patients. I tested them with a variety of tests, intelligence tests, memory tests, all sorts of things, as much time as I could have before the operation. And then I would test them again afterwards in order to see what the effects had been. And then if I was lucky, I would test them in follow-up, so on. Mm-hmm. And so I saw the patient. And then he had this operation, which was just removal, really, of the amygdala and hippocampus on the medial surface, just really to complete what had by then become a standard removal. And after that, this patient said, "What have you done to my memory?" And he was quite sad. And it of course, he knew Dr. Penfield because he'd had surgery a few years earlier. He knew Dr. Penfield and he knew the neuro and so on. I had worked with him for hours and hours, but he didn't know me at all. And wow. He didn't know any of the newer residents or staff that had worked with him. He had some retrograde amnesia, didn't remember when they'd installed a new furnace in his house and so on. But the serious thing was the what we call an anterograde amnesia, the continuous forgetting of the experience of his life as he lived then. This patient, he got a little bit of a glimmering as the day went off. He would say in the morning he woke up and it was buzzing, booming confusion. And then he got a little clarity, but he forgot everything from day to day. And of course, it changed his whole life from then on. Now, this was disconcerting. Now, it was this patient that enabled me to show that first of all, that the IQ, the general intelligence, is not changed by this. What had happened to this patient, his overall intelligence was not changed. I was high. He was a highly educated, highly intelligent man. His immediate memory, his ability to repeat a series of digits after hearing them, the immediate capacity of immediate memory, which was again superior in this guy to begin with, was not changed and was not affected. So we know that primary memory, what William James called this immediate memory, primary memory, I think it's a good term, was unchanged. But it was the inability to build up his life from then on, which was so shocking. And we wondered, Dr. Penfield, Dr. Jasper and I, we really wondered and worried what is going on. And I remember Dr. Jasper trying to reassure Dr. Penfield and saying there must be something peculiar about this patient, maybe something down in his brainstem we don't know about. And here I would remind you again, I can't emphasize it enough, that we had no way of really seeing what was going on in his brain except that bit of the temporal lobe that was exposed at the surgery in the left hemisphere. So any speculation was possible. Now, this was a situation when about a month later, we saw another case of this. We saw a young man, a glove cutter by profession, actually, from a family of glove cutters, who came. He was 28 years old, and he had a left temporal lobectomy again. This time, a one-stage one of removing the lateral surface and the medial structures, including a good deal of the hippocampus, and he showed this effect. It was interesting that he was able to go on doing his glove cutting and learning, which is a motor skill. It was an interesting thing. So he wasn't as incapacitated actually as being able to work as the other patient, but the same thing, forgetting from moment to moment. And at that point, we really had to sit down and think, what could this mean? It was unacceptable. You cannot, in elective surgery, have this risk of this devastating memory impairment is so much worse than having epilepsy that, you know, you can't in good conscience go on like that. And of course, we also had to report these cases. So Dr. Penfield and I, I can't remember really the course of this conversation, but we hypothesized between us that perhaps in these patients there was, unknown to the surgeon, unknown to any of us before the surgery, some atrophy, some damage in the medial temporal region, in the hippocampal region of the opposite hemisphere, the unoperated hemisphere, because remember, we couldn't see that. And these epilepsies, these temporal lobe epilepsies, typically, not invariably, but typically, are attributable to something that happens very near birth, either before birth or some febrile illness in the very first months of life, and can easily affect both the medial structures. And, you know, and we know now, of course, in these days, with our enlightened possibilities because of very good MR, structural MR, magnetic resonance imaging. So we can see now actual atrophy, sclerosis, in the hippocampus in many of these patients that probably goes back to the first either pre-birth or early years of their life, although the epilepsy itself may only manifest itself around adolescence or even later. So that it's quite possible, quite reasonable, that there could be damage in both hemispheres. But we couldn't see this. We just speculated that why are we getting this huge effect when we have this long, by that time, a long series of patients with unilateral lesions who never showed anything like this at all, just showed these rather specific little memory deficits that I had been studying, which were really not too serious, you know, for the patient compared with the epilepsy. Instead, you're seeing this huge changing their whole life because they're not remembering from moment to moment. I don't know if any of your readers, or sorry, your listeners have seen the film Memento, but this is a wonderful picture of this state of mind in which you really know that you're going to forget, you know, from moment to moment, anything you want to retain, you have to write down, you have, because you're not going to keep it. These patients have very good insight that they have this memory impairment, and yet they cannot, of course, compensate for it. So we speculated, Dr. Penfield and I, and this was in 1953, that in these two patients, unbeknownst to the surgeon, there must be some damage in the hippocampal region of the opposite hemisphere. Now, why hippocampal? Why hippocampal? Well, because PB, if you remember, had the lateral surface of the temporal lobe removed in the previous operation, and this had not left him with this memory impairment. It was only when Dr. Penfield extended that removal onto the medial surface, and we didn't know. He'd always been respectful of the hippocampus because it's such a beautiful structure, and it's a very big structure and a very ancient structure phylogenetically, but no, we didn't know what it did, but it must do something important. And we believed that. So when we said, and as I later said with the surgeon Scoville, the hippocampal syndrome, we did not mean that this was that the hippocampus was the only important structure involved in this big memory impairment, but that it was played a critical role. We were very sure. We guessed that was what we thought. And I have to say that 12 years later, PB died 12 years later from something quite different, from a pulmonary embolus, nothing to do with the brain. And Dr. Penfield and his neuropathologist, Dr. Matheson, were able to study the brain and confirm this hypothesis that with clinical pathological verification, because there was indeed more atrophy in the hippocampal region on the unoperated side than there was removal made by Dr. Penfield. It was again, the early days of EEG, probably misled by thinking that the seizures were starting on the left when perhaps they were not. But however this may be at the time, to account for these two cases of severe and generalized memory loss, we speculated that, and it was pure conjecture, that we were seeing the effects of a bilateral lesion. And I reported these findings with Dr. Penfield at the meeting of the American Neurological Association in Chicago in 1954, maybe. And that was when Dr. William Scoville, a surgeon, a neurosurgeon in Hartford, Connecticut, attached to Yale University, I think, practicing in Hartford, Connecticut, was also a member of ANA and read our abstract, and he called, and he actually came to the meeting and commented on the paper, and he called Dr. Penfield after and said, you know, I think that I have seen the sort of memory impairment that you have described in the patients in whom I have carried out my operation. And I would like, down in Hartford, Connecticut, mm-hmm. and I would like to invite you to come and study, you or Dr. Milner or any of your, you know, whoever, to come down and study my patients. And so Dr. Penfield said to me, would you like to go? And I said, of course. And that was the beginning of, I know you've heard of the patient HM. I just mm-hmm. wanted people to realize that my introduction to amnesia and to this kind of patient was not with HM. It was with Dr. Penfield's patients right here in Montreal, the patient PB particularly, that I had the advantage in these cases of studying them before the surgery. Now, HM I only met for the first time after the surgery, and HM also was had a very little of a life. I don't know if you want me to go on talking about HM at this point, or if that gives you enough background and you want to ask me something else. I'm not sure where we're going from here.
Perhaps a little bit about HM. I mean, people can cross-reference him on Wikipedia. I mean, there's enough material there for them to also go and to look at as well and get a good feel for the story because of his fame. So if you could tell us a little bit about patient HM and what you found.
Yes, certainly. Sure. Well, first of all, I should explain the background, because this is that Dr. Scoville's cases like that and Penfield's. Penfield said it almost, I mean, he didn't mean it in a sort of cold-blooded way. He just meant, just by chance, that these two that Scoville's studies and Penfield's, that they almost, they complemented each other almost like a planned experiment, which of course they were not, because well, the background to what Scoville was doing was this. First of all, HM was, I always used to call him a young man, but HM is 82 now, but he was 29 when I first met him in 1955, and he'd had his surgery in 1927. But HM had had, had grown up a young man with an only child with rather elderly parents, and he... we don't quite know why he developed his epilepsy. He had a minor bicycle accident when he was minor unconsciousness, I think, when he was seven, and he developed some seizures a little after this, but it was, the accident was not enough to produce seizures in itself. It's not clear quite. Also, his seizures were not typical of a temporal lobe seizures at all. They were much more like what you think of when you talked to me earlier about these severe epilepsies. He was having major convulsions several times a week and many, many little lapses of attention, little sort of absence attacks, which again is not typical of temporal lobe epilepsy at all, in between. And he was on maximum doses of the anticonvulsant medications of the day, whatever the was he had it. He was really, really obtunded with all this medication. And still, in spite of that, the seizures were breaking through and he was having, he's turned out to be, you know, quite a bright, intelligent young man, but he was, you know, all these drugs were affecting him, all these seizures were affecting him. He didn't graduate from high school till he was really quite old. And then he got a job as a motor winder in a factory, but even that was very difficult because you were working in a factory and you have major epileptic seizures. That doesn't work either. And so he had consulted Dr. Scoville, more as you would consult a neurologist, you know, what can be done about this epilepsy? And they had, and there had been some EEGs done on him at the time, and again, it didn't look like temporal lobe epilepsy. He had widespread generalized abnormality in both sides of the brain, but nothing that looked like a focal lesion. But in the meantime, Dr. Scoville had been... Well, again, you have to get a sense of history here. I didn't know Scoville then. I met Scoville only when I, in the context of HM. But... and Scoville was a very good surgeon. He was a very skilled surgeon. This was the bad period, the heyday of frontal lobotomies for schizophrenic patients. It was before they developed any medications really or any other treatment for severe mental illness. And so there had been all these frontal lobotomies done, and they gave very... they were very worrying in the sense that the patients became what Scoville described as, I haven't worked with these patients, but Scoville described as a blunting of the personality or something. And Scoville did not want to go on doing frontal lobotomies for schizophrenia. And so he wondered about whether if he did some medial temporal operations, that this, because the temporal lobe, that part of the temporal lobe was connected to parts of the frontal lobe, that maybe he could have some help with schizophrenia rather than without some of the bad effects. And so he had developed a technique of doing a bilateral, in Montreal we would never be doing bilateral operations, right? You would do it on one side of the brain on the assumption or the hope that the corresponding region on the other side is working. You can get along with one kidney or one eye and so on, but you don't lose both. And so this is the philosophy in general, that you don't do bilaterally symmetrical lesions. As I told you, you need the bilateral lesion in the monkey to show the full effects of a function of an area, for example. So bilateral lesions are not what you're doing. You're doing unilateral lesions for epilepsy. But in the case of the schizophrenic patients, the approach was different, and so Scoville had developed this operation, which was a bilateral procedure, but it was only on the medial structures of the temporal lobe, not the lateral, and this is why Penfield regarded it as a sort of complementary. We had, in the case of the surgery, I'm talking the surgery now, of PB and FC, we had a unilateral temporal lobe lesion, but it included the neocortex as well as the medial structures. What Scoville was doing was a bilateral procedure, but which there the the neocortex. And incidentally, we've had MR studies of HM much more recently, and the operation that was done was exactly as Scoville described it, only it was somewhat less extensive, and it indeed spared the temporal neocortex. However, why we're not talking about HM now, we're talking about this operation which he had perfected, practiced for the treatment of a very, very ill schizophrenic patients. I was able to study a few of these later, but they were really very, very sick people, and the operation did not change their schizophrenia. So they were difficult to work with, and Scoville had not himself worked with them. He had done the surgery, but he had, with that goal in mind, perfected the surgical approach to this operation, and that's why he referred to it as his operation. Mm-hmm. Now you see Scoville confronted by this young man who was not schizophrenic, very nice, ordinary sort of personality, HM, very, very nice, well brought up, nice young man, but who has this terrible epilepsy. And he consults Scoville over and over, and finally Scoville suggests the possibility. And this is why HM knows that he's had the surgery. He knows it because it was discussed. It wasn't embarked on impulsively. It was discussed over a long period that there was this operation. And Scoville had become very impressed from the work of Penfield. He had become very impressed by the fact that sort of epileptogenicity, if you like the term, of these medial structures of the temporal lobe, the fact that so often this was the villain in the piece of temporal lobe epilepsy. And so he had the hypothesis that if he removed those structures in HM, it might benefit him, although he did not have focal temporal lobe seizures, it might benefit his epilepsy. And so this was why the operation was carried out in HM. And the amazing thing is that Dr. Scoville was in fact right, that although the boy did not have temporal lobe seizures, it didn't seem, yet this operation had an extremely beneficial effect on his epilepsy, that he's able to, he has maybe one big seizure a year, and he has still has these little lapses of attention on and again. He's on so much reduced dose of medication, and I mean, it was. So Scoville's hunch that he might help this patient's epilepsy turned out to be thoroughly justified. And then I always add, but at a totally unjustified, you know, that the trade-off was unacceptable, you know, obviously unacceptable. Mm-hmm. But whereas my colleague, Dr. Suzanne Corkin, who was my graduate student then and now at MIT, who has followed HM all these years, would even debate that, because HM was really destined to go really, excuse me, to go really downhill with the epilepsy, with the drugs and the epilepsy and mm-hmm. so on. He had a very dismal future either way. Nevertheless, to me, it seems it was an unacceptable price to pay, which of course Scoville did not know what was going to happen. So this was HM, and I was invited then to go down and see him. And so I went. I was very naive. I always say this, that it was 1950, and I think in 1955 when I met HM. And I really, you know, by hindsight now, I would say I was extremely naive, but I suppose everybody was about amnesia in those days, because there'd been a lot of clinical descriptions of amnesia in elderly people, but the actual trying to break down and analyze what they could and couldn't do was new. However, I went down and I met HM, and first of all, I went with a pretty open mind about what I was going to find. He was very pleasant and courteous, and I would give him numbers to repeat and remember. And I remember, perhaps this gives you the feel of this, I gave him the number 584, went out for 20 minutes, came back. He said, 5, 8, and 4 add up to 17. Divide by 2. You have 8 and 9. Remember 8. And then he said very solemnly, remember 8. And then 5 and then 9, it gives you, divide by 2, you have 5 and 4. So there you have, 5, 8, 4. And then he said it's simple. And he'd been playing around with these numbers, you know, for this 20 minutes. And he said, and explaining the mnemonic for me. And he said it's simple. And so I said, and do you remember my name? Do you remember? I've introduced myself lots of times. No, I'm sorry. The trouble is my memory. And then I laughed. Wow. And then I said, and what was the number? And then he looked at me and he said, number? Was there a number? So you see, the whole essence of this is that he had kept these numbers, it's 584, going by constant rehearsal, remembering the eight and so on, and talking to himself really through this period. But as soon as he was distracted, he had absolutely no access to this anymore. It had gone. And this was really the heart of this. And in fact, these patients can only keep something going really by verbal rehearsal. If you give them, they have to remember the shape of an ellipse, for example, and then pick it out later, as Murray Sidman was able to show in Boston, pick it out from a group of other ellipses, do a delayed matching task a few seconds later. After about 30 seconds, they seem to retain no representation of the item they were shown before the interval in order to match it later. It's only if they can actually verbalize and keep talking to themselves. And you see that, actually. You see them during memory tests, you see the lips moving and HM as he talks to himself, really, and keeping something going with very high motivation, but with, wow, with total failure once they're distracted. So this was the situation. Well, then, as a psychologist, and we mustn't forget that that's what I am, I said, it's not satisfactory just to say that patients with these lesions cannot remember anything. If you don't try to train them with repeated practice, can they learn anything? You can't just say you can't prove the null hypothesis. You just can't say these patients can't do anything. So go back and see if I can do some learning tasks with a patient or bring them with multiple trials. Can I train the patient to do something? And in those days, I would go over to the psychology department at McGill, because by now I was based at the neuro. I would trot down to the psychology department and look in the elementary psychology, experimental psychology lab, and pick up a couple of tasks that I could take. I took the night train to Hartford in those days from Montreal, arriving somewhere early in the morning in Hartford, and with whatever I'd been able to carry with me, and spending the next two or three days working with HM, and then taking my data and my equipment back to Montreal and pondering over it. And that was when I had my first real breakthrough. I still find this perhaps one of the most exciting things. And this is back in of 57, something like that. I go down and I took some mazes. I took learning tasks that he failed, really. Predictably, I thought he would fail, but I had to give him a chance, and some maze learning tasks and so on. We would do a lot of practice one day and continue over the 3 days I was there, and with no progress. And that was more or less, you know, what you were expecting. But where I had the breakthrough was in a sensory motor task, a mirror drawing task that I picked up from the psychology lab here. In this little task, you see a five-pointed star with a double outline, a double contour, a five-pointed star drawn on a sheet of paper. And you're given a pencil, and you have to start at the top of the star there and try to trace a line keeping within the narrow confines of this star until you've lean right round it and come to where you started. Now, that sounds awfully easy. The trouble is that you only see your hand and the star as reflected in a mirror. And that means that if you try it, you'll find this. Whenever you come to it's very difficult doing these drawing tests in the mirror when you haven't done them before. And when you find yourself at the point of the star, your hand goes back and forth as you try to correct and you make bigger movements. But the wonderful thing, of course, is that we learn. We learn rapidly with practice. We learn with practice. You can't tell somebody how to do it. You just learn with practice. You learn by doing. It's a motor skill. And the wonderful thing was that HM learned in completely normally. I did 10 trials with him on the day one, and his errors were diminishing, beautiful learning curve. And then the next day, of course, he didn't know me, let alone the fact that he'd done it. But he started again, started more or less where he'd left off. And then day three, at the end, after he'd done these 30 trials, he had the most beautiful performance, absolutely perfect. And he looked a little puzzled as he finished this trajectory and said, I thought that would be hard, you know. And he had absolutely no memory at all of ever having done this task before. So he was really impressed at himself that he had, you know, he thought doing this in the mirror, it would be difficult. And instead, he'd done it so perfectly. So one part of his brain had been learning, acquiring this skill. And the other part, whereas the rest of him, HM, was not even retaining the memory of the experience, an amazing dissociation. That was a very, I mean, this is banal now, everybody knows this, but it was so exciting the first time to see it. There was some early evidence that of multiple memory systems in the brain, because obviously this kind of motor learning was going on independently of the hippocampal, what I'm going to call loosely the hippocampal, the medial temporal system. And I speculated then that motor skills would be learned with a different kind of learning that they, and there was already, of course, in experimental psychologists would be perfectly happy with this. They, even those who were not interested in the brain would think, often thought of motor learning as following somewhat different rules. You know, these are the kinds of things, sports that you learn best in when you're young, survive from season to season. You know, you know how to swim, and then you don't swim till the next summer, but you still know how to swim. But most importantly, there are things that you can't describe what you've learned. If your stroke at tennis or at golf improves with practice or with lessons, you cannot, with that, after the practice, say, well, you know, you're doing better now. What is it you've learned? You can't possibly say. And even the attempt to analyze in what way you've improved or changed what you're doing destroys the performance, because you learn by doing, and it's a different system in your brain. And now we know that a lot of these motor skills are mediated through parts of the basal ganglia, part of the motor system, and have nothing whatever to do with this medial temporal region. And then shortly thereafter, some colleagues of mine in England, Elizabeth Warrington, Professor Warrington at Queen's Square, London, and Professor Weisskranz in Oxford, working together with some amnesic patients, people who, everybody wanted their amnesic patient at this point. It became interesting, and they were working with patients who had herpes encephalitis, which can sort of sneak in through your nose and attack the medial structures of the temporal lobe, and sometimes leaves people with this kind of memory impairment. And they had worked with such patients, and they were finding some sort of perceptual learning, I call it, which is now called priming, a kind of priming, where, you know, if you look at a puzzle picture long enough, you may not see it. If somebody shows you a puzzle picture, something that's meant to be a bit confusing to identify, you won't see it. You may take quite a while to see it. But once you've seen it, you can be shown that picture months later, and you will see it much faster, much quicker. So you've learned something. And they tested this with fragmented drawings of common objects, and you just see a little bit of an impoverished circumference, a few clues to the outline of this object, which could be an airplane or a telephone or a chair, and say, what could this be? And you can gradually add contour until you see it. And then the next time you're shown this set of pictures, you see it with less information. It requires less filling in of the contour to recognize what the object is. And that is, I would call, a perceptual learning. A priming, you've been primed by your previous experience. Mm-hmm. And this kind of learning, we know, is dependent upon the visual cortex. And the cortex is different, again, from the motor skills, and different from the sort of memory that I'm studying this with the medial temporal lobe. And this was a discovery of Warrington and Weisskranz, but I replicated it in HM, who showed, again, normal priming also, although, again, not being aware that he'd ever seen these pictures before. So that was another example. And so and gradually, of course, psychologists have studied other kinds of learning, conditioning, in which parts of the cerebellum are very much involved. So this whole idea of multiple different kinds of memory in the brain is very well established. But I would say some of the very early and critical evidence for this came from this mirror drawing study in HM.
Wow. So that's amazing. So that's one experiment that sort of shifted the area of neuroscience. It is a very pivotal point. It must have been pretty exciting to see.
It was very exciting. Of course, you have to sell these things. You're realizing, you're very much aware of this, I'm sure, talking to different scientists, that this sort of history of ideas and so on, that it goes through this phase. At first, you have to convince people that this part of the brain really is so important. For, you know, this is such a circumscribed lesion and such a very devastating effect on a critical part of every human being's existence, really, this memory of one's autobiography, so to speak. And so there's always a little skepticism until you get an animal model. And it's very hard at first because it is a difficult thing just intuitively to know what is going to be the right the equivalent to ask from a monkey that has to learn something over many trials, maybe, and what you ask of a person. And it took a long time to get a good animal model, which came out with Mort Mishkin's work in 1976, but that was 20 years later, to show that such lesions in the monkey really did produce a monkey that couldn't do a delayed match, that couldn't bridge an interval after a single trial. But it took, you know, a lot of false starts, a lot of false approaches before we reached that. And so, and there was all, in the meantime, there were people saying, well, maybe humans are not like monkeys, which is a very distressing thought because I rely a lot on what we know about monkeys. And then, or maybe HM is not amnesic, which was a silly thought. I mean, anybody who'd worked with HM knew that he was amnesic, but people were just trying to make sense of all this. And then once it got really accepted and that these different kinds of memory became evident that they were separate, then it's somehow acquired an enormous impetus. I mean, memory is such a hot area of research these days. It wasn't back then. It wasn't particularly fashionable back then. So it's very curious. So what I was saying is that you must realize from all the people you've talked to, I'm sure, this strange trajectory whereby at the beginning people question something and then it gets established and they say, well, maybe, yeah, you know, they're not so interested, and then suddenly it takes off. It's very...
Oh, absolutely.
Strange thing to live, you know.
I would call it, you know, first they think you're crazy, then they think, well, maybe it's true. And then the next level is it, if you're working on fundamental processes of biology or any science, I think that's where it goes. First they think you're crazy, then they think, well, maybe it's true. And then
that's right.
that this is how it works. And this is what gets into our understanding of ourselves. Or the universe itself. I think this is a tremendous story, in that we do have a lot of scientists that listen. And from your early work and your determination to get accepted to the program, the PhD program, you know, that showed a level of tenacity and a level of curiosity that you took the risk of doing the risky science, being a psychologist going into an area of clinical neuroscience and taking that risk. So you're one, tenacious, and two, curious, so curious that you took a major risk. I hope people can take some inspiration as to, one, be tenacious, and two, take risks, because that's how we're going to advance our understanding of ourselves. And I really appreciate you coming on. It's a great honor for me to have you on the show.
Yes, I don't think you think about the risk, you know, when you're just driven by the curiosity. And then once you're embarked on it, of course, that's where the tenacity comes in.
I'd like to thank Dr. Milner for her time today and for sharing her fantastic scientific work with us. I'd like to also thank Dr. Dave Broadbeck for helping with the introduction. You can hear more from Dave in his series of podcasts at thunderbird6.org. Thanks to Will Hall for the opening and closing themes, and to the listeners for helping support this podcast. Thank you for your donations. Just before going, I'd like to mention that the transcripts for today's show have been made available by the kind folks at Pods in Print. You can find a link to these transcripts in our show notes. For Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Peltier.